Hi, I'm Mike Collins. We'll get to the Charlotte Talks podcast in just a moment. First, I want to tell you about a special public conversation I'm hosting, and you're invited to join me and several of Charlotte's African-American leaders for Building an Inclusive City. That's on February 21st, 7 p.m. at Spirit Square. We'll be talking with Charlotte's mayor, police chief, city manager, and district attorney. Details and free registration at WFAE.org, and we hope to see you there. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Dan Rather first came into most people's consciousness in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination.
We just have a report from our correspondent Dan Rather in Dallas that President Kennedy is dead.
He was the first to break the news that the president had been killed. He was near the beginning of a 44-year tenure with CBS News, one that would include a stint in Vietnam.
This is the 25th Infantry Division, the newest troops in South Vietnam for the United States.
Time as a White House correspondent and covering the civil rights movement and Watergate.
One White House source told CBS News that President Nixon is considering a resignation.
Ultimately, he would succeed Walter Cronkite as anchor of the CBS Evening News, a position he would hold for 24 years.
September 11th, 2001. You will remember this day as long as you live.
He left that anchor chair in 2005 and since then has continued to contribute to the media landscape, from Dan Rather Reports to the big interview both on Access TV to his latest venture on the progressive The Young Turks Network. And he joins the ranks of The Young Turks at the age of 86. Dan Rather also has a new book out, What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism, a collection of essays on topics ranging from voting rights to immigration to science. Recently described as a millennial darling, Rather will be speaking tomorrow night at 7 in an evening with Dan Rather under the auspices of the Learning Society at Queen's University of Charlotte. As a testimony to Dan Rather's ongoing popularity, they had to move the event to a larger venue, the Belk Theater. And in advance of that appearance, Mr. Rather joins us for the hour. Welcome, and thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
Well, great to be talking to you again, Mike.
Yes, we spoke years and years and years ago, but we'll let that go by the wayside. Like so many of the early pioneers in broadcast news, you wanted to be a newspaper reporter. What is it about reporting that appeals to you?
Well, there's so many things that appeal to me about it. Some of them are kind of mysterious to myself. The only thing I have ever remember wanting to be is a reporter. When we played those games as kids, some people wanted to be an Indian chief, some people wanted to be an airplane pilot or an astronaut or something. I always said I wanted to be a reporter. I think it was because my parents, neither of whom had finished high school, which was not that unusual in their time and place, Texas during the Depression, they were very avid newspaper readers. They read the newspapers, they discussed the newspapers, and I think somewhere along the line as, 4 or 5 years old, I began to think that newspapers must be important because my parents spent so much time with them. But from that very early age on, being a reporter is all I've ever wanted to do. And I do recognize how blessed I am to have been able to make a living doing what I had a passion for doing. Now, what is it that appeals to me? There's so many things. First of all, I have a curiosity. Most people do, but I may have an extra dose of curiosity. I love to learn about things. I've never been, an outstanding student, not a bad student, but being in journalism, being a reporter is like being in a sort of a constant graduate school. You're always learning, so I like that about it. And I'd have to say I also like the sense of adventure. There is that with journalism, particularly if one is able to play it at anywhere near the top level. And maybe the most important thing is that, I always wanted to be part of something bigger than myself, to contribute in some small, maybe even microscopic way to the country and to make things better. It's just, and being part of journalism gives me a sense of, journalism when it's done right counts. It matters. Gives me no small amount of satisfaction.
When you started out, though, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I don't know that your ultimate goal was to be the anchor of a TV newscast, because they didn't really exist back then. What was your ultimate goal? How high did you want to go in the profession? Was it just a local newspaper in Texas, or did you want to be at the New York Times or the Washington?
No. That my dream for a very long time was to be a big byline reporter for one of our local newspapers. We had three newspapers in Houston where I grew up, with the Houston Chronicle, Houston Post, Houston Press. And, you know, my dream, and it seemed an unreachable star at the time, was to be, as I say, a byline reporter for one of our local newspapers. The very idea of, when I started out, of being even on radio, much less television, frankly, it didn't enter my mind. And the New York Times might as well have been as far away as the planet Pluto for me. Now, that changed over the years, particularly once I got my big break and was hired out of Houston to come to CBS News. Then I began to dream larger. But up until, I don't know, shortly before I was named to succeed Walter Cronkite, my dream was not to do the CBS Evening News. I thought, and I had been told, that probably would not happen. Several other people were going to most likely be chosen. It just was not a dream of mine. Now, it is true that once, when Walter Cronkite said that he wanted to retire, and it was his choice, and it was said, I'm in a race to see who was succeeding. Well, at that point, I said, well, if there's a race, I guess I better try to win it. But there wasn't much one could do because the decision was in the hands of course, the ownership and executives at CBS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, newspapers were very powerful when you first got into this business, and then you went very quickly, if I understand your biography correctly, you went very quickly from print to radio, and very quickly from radio to TV. You went to TV in 1959. That was kind of the birth of television news. It was primitive technically. It wasn't very portable. Radio was more immediate than television because it could go on the scene. TV really couldn't. Some other pioneers didn't really think much of television back in those early days, and some of them didn't want to do it. Did you understand the potential of TV?
No, I did not. And for that reason, I was rather slow to go into it. In this sense, that I was very happy. I had, frankly, not done well as a wire service reporter, a newspaper reporter. I was a good reporter. I could write pretty well, but I was an atrocious speller, which is a great vulnerability to have in the newspaper. And so I got pushed over to radio. I really enjoyed radio. And to answer your question, when I got into television, frankly, I had no idea that television and television news were moving as fast as they were in the late 1950s. I went to television primarily because I had gotten married. I had two young children almost right in a row quickly after I got married. And there's no gentle way to put this. I was pressed to make the car payments and pay the rent. And while television didn't pay better than radio, it was more guaranteed. I won't go into details, but in radio I was paid by the program, and I couldn't be guaranteed an annual income of a certain amount, whereas television I could. So that was the main reason I went in. But the point, and I think what's behind your question is well taken, that when I got into television news was new. Nobody really knew quite what the full potential of it was. And everything from the ethics of the business to how to cover for television, we were all making it up as we went along. And it was, looking back on it, it was one of the most exciting and satisfying periods of my career, those early days in television, because, as I say, most people had no idea what to do with it. So we experimented, we tried this and tried that, and sort of made up as we went along. It wasn't until the Kennedy assassination in 1963 that television news really came of age and became the dominant source where most Americans got most of their news.
Television cut its chops on the Kennedy assassination. It unified the nation. It showed the power of what TV could do. And you got into television just a few years before that, in 1959, and then you went to CBS in just a matter of a few years. In 62, you were there to be the chief of the Southwest Bureau in Dallas. You took over the Southern Bureau in 63. And that is how, I guess, you came to be the man who broke the news of the Kennedy assassination.
Well, let's switch now to news correspondent Dan Rather in Dallas.
Pandemonium broke out at the scene of the shooting as three shots emerged from somewhere in the crowd. One child told authorities that he saw a man lean out of the fifth floor of one of the buildings and fire the shots.
You did that first on CBS radio. Television evidently knew about it, but didn't break it as quickly as radio did until we had that iconic shot of Walter Cronkite taking off his glasses to announce that the president had died. Why did radio go with it first?
Well, it is rather interesting what happened. You know, the assassination of President Kennedy was just an emotional earthquake for the country, and including those of us who were in Dallas to cover the president's trip. Chaos reigned. Everything from questions of, well, were the Russians responsible for this assassination of the president, to what is the country going to do? And in the chaos of that, when I and our CBS News team, we confirmed that the president was dead. You know, for a long time it was a question whether he was hit. He was hit seriously. And on a telephone conversation at CBS News headquarters in New York, in one part of the building was and remains CBS radio. In another part of the building is CBS television. I was on the telephone with CBS radio. I said, you know, we've confirmed it. There's no longer any question. You know, he's dead. Radio made an immediate decision. They played the Star Spangled Banner. They came, and then came on with an announcement the president was dead.
President John Kennedy is dead in Dallas, Texas.
Television, which was not on the telephone with me at the time, was informed. And a man named Ernie Leiser, who had actually hired me at CBS News, there wasn't any doubt in his mind about our report was true, but he made a decision for television that we ought to wait for a bit for the official announcement. He thought the official announcement would be coming, you know, momentarily. As it turned out, time was going by, so eventually television quoted what I had done on radio. Kind of complicated, but it shows that, you know, as you well know, Mike, news is not a precise science. On its best days, it's a kind of crude art. And on that day, the division between CBS radio and CBS television, the television side made a decision to, they thought it was in the national interest just to wait. But the longer they waited and there was no official announcement, then they finally had Walter Cronkite say that we had confirmed it, not in an offhand way, but not in a very forceful way. And they waited until the official announcement by the U.S. government, which happened just past the hour. My recollection is the 1 o'clock hour in the Central Time Zone and 2 o'clock hour in New York. But at any rate, that's the way news comes together. It's sometimes messy, and it was that day.
That day, November 22nd, 1963, was the day that I guess Dan Rather came into a lot of people's consciousness because the event took place in Dallas, and we focused our attention on Dallas for a good part of a weekend, a very long commercial-free weekend on all three major networks covering the assassination. But Dan Rather found himself covering, he would go on to cover, almost every single, I think probably every single major event of our lifetime. And we will come back and talk about that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dan Rather is our guest, author of What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. We'll be talking about that a little bit later on. He'll be in town tomorrow night to speak at 7 o'clock at the Belk Theater under the auspices of the Learning Society of the Queen's University of Charlotte. I mean this in the best possible sense. You are the Forrest Gump of American journalism, because you've been in the center of every single story that made a difference in our lifetimes, from the Kennedy assassination to Vietnam to being hauled off the floor at the 1968 Democratic National Convention.
Take your hands off of me. Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please. I know you will, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you intend to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
The covering of Watergate, the resignation of Richard Nixon, the fall of the Berlin Wall.
All the joy and the history in front of the Brandenburg Gate, with West Berliners partying literally on top of the Berlin Wall.
You're not only on the front lines reporting those stories, your coverage is what many Americans remember of those stories. And that was the power, I think, of the TV anchorman when you sat in that chair. It was you, Peter Jennings on ABC, Tom Brokaw on NBC. How did that responsibility, there were just three of you, shape the way you thought about and the way you approached covering the news?
Well, Mike, I can truthfully say that I didn't spend very much time thinking about, you know, the weight of what we were doing and being part of the so-called Big Three. I always felt there was some danger in that. Quite frankly, when I came in a surprise to me and was named to succeed Walter Cronkite, that I knew that I couldn't be another Walter Cronkite. There was only one. And I thought, well, I better be the best Dan Rather I can be, which sounds a little cliché, but that's the way I felt about it. In other words, I always thought, you know, I'm a reporter, and I want to remain a reporter anchor, not an anchor reporter. And therefore, I tried to go in the field as much as I could. And I didn't think very much about the weight of the job, if you will, or how we were influencing American society. What I tried to be was an honest broker of information. And mentally, my attitude when I came to the broadcast each night was, folks, you know, I may not be the smoothest anchor man around, and I'm not the world's greatest reporter, but I'm doing the best I can here to be that honest broker of information with you.
Do you think about it? Do you think about the awesome power you had back then, today?
You know, I can truthfully say that I didn't think the phrase awesome power never came into my mind. What I did have, I always thought it was a big responsibility.
Okay.
But that didn't translate into feeling an awesome power. And a great part of it was I realized I represented, as the so-called face of the network, hundreds, indeed at one point, several thousand CBS News people. And if there's any burden about it, that was the burden of wanting to do it as well as I could for them, because I knew how hard they worked. But I know what you're getting about. But there was power in anchoring one of the three network newscasts through the 1980s and 1990s, and on, for that matter, into 2000. But I never thought of it in those terms. I always thought of it as a responsibility. And I wanted a trust, and then I wanted to meet the responsibilities of that trust as best I could.
Because back then, I don't know that it's still the case today. But back then, you were not only the anchor, the guy who does a little writing and tosses to stories put out by other reporters and reads the teleprompter. You were the managing editor. You decided what stories were going to be covered, how much weight they were going to be given, what their position in the newscast was going to be. And the newscast is about 26 to 28 minutes long. And at the time, there were three nightly newscasts. That was it. There were no CNNs, no MSNBCs, no Fox Newses. That was it. So you were giving people their daily diet of news. You controlled what they were going to see and learn about. So with that came a lot of weight. And it seemed back then that, because your book is about unify, about unity, what unites us. Back then, when there were only three anchors and three networks, we were more united. Today, we have hundreds of choices, and we're just all over the place.
Well, and I think those two things are somewhat connected. That we are more divided today than we have been in a long time. We were very divided during the 1960s, and we have had previous times we were divided. But I do think some of this divisiveness is a result of the fracturing of news sources, not news sources, but news platforms. That is, the distribution of news has become so fractured, so widespread. I think there are positives to that. One of the negatives is the tendency of people to just want to hear news that corresponds to their own views. And it has led to a kind of national attitude of, don't bother me with the facts, I have my mind made up. You know, when I won't say they were better days, they were different days, when the three network evening newscasts really were a kind of national hearth, a kind of fire around which the nation gathered at the evening, and there was a general expectation that, look, they're going to make their mistakes, and I won't always like what they say, but what these men are trying to do, and we all were all men at that time, Jennings, Brokaw, and myself, what these men are trying to do is, as I used the phrase before, be honest brokers of information, give us in the 26, 28 minutes they have at least a tip-off as to what are the most important developments in the world today and what are the most interesting developments in the world today.
So how did we get from there to here? How did we go from Walter Cronkite being the most trusted man in America with Chet Huntley and David Brinkley not terribly far behind, to where we are today, where the media is, the mainstream media is alleged to be fake news? How did we get here?
Well, that's a question. It may be beyond my depth, Mike, but I'll give it my try. When Walter Cronkite, when he was at his height, there were really only two network news organizations. There was only CBS and NBC. We're talking about the late 60s and early 70s. It was a different country. It was a different news, and news and media in general were much smaller. Now, how we got from there to here includes those of us in news, and I do not accept myself in this criticism. You know, we've made some mistakes that we've gone through. I don't want to say that it's none of it's to blame on the press itself. Some of it is. But among the other things that have happened is that in the political realm, many political leaders have found that by emphasizing divisions in the country, racial divisions, income divisions, and raising suspicions about the press helps them in their partisan political ways. And that has been a factor. Another obvious factor has been the availability, once we got to the internet, in what I would call, we're now in the post-digital age, then a lot of things in society changed, and including trust in everything from people in political power to news. That's part of how we got from where we were to where we are. But I think the major question now is, where do we go from here?
Right.
That there are members of the national political leadership who have tried to convince us that we've moved into a post-truth political era where truth no longer matters. It doesn't matter whether you're telling the truth or not.
But that makes no sense at all.
It makes absolutely no sense. And I will say, Mike, that, you know, it's a difficult time. Let's face it. We're in a perilous time for the country. But I have such confidence in Americans in general. In my experience in journalism, the audience sometimes is slow to catch on to things. They're slow to adjust to things. they'll come around. I don't think most Americans want a post-truth political era in which facts don't matter. And the whole idea, the ridiculous idea, that, well, all facts are kind of fungible, and there's such a thing as alternative facts. Listen, a six-year-old school child knows that, you know, 2 and 2 equals 4, period. It does not equal 6 or 7. It also, you know, water does not run uphill. There are such things as facts. And Americans in general know that. And while I am worried about the present time and this whole business of, well, facts don't matter and there's no such thing as truth, and that all journalists are peddling nothing but fake news all the time, every day, it's taken some traction, and it's worrisome. But in the end, I think we'll get through this period and we'll be all right.
People don't have an understanding, a real understanding, and I'm not sure why that is. We live in a free country that's had a free press since its founding, and I don't understand why people have such difficulty coming to terms with the fact that occasionally reporters will be at loggerheads with politicians, with leaders. And you found yourself on several occasions in your career kind of entangled in an adversarial way with the president or the vice president. Back during Watergate, you kind of tangled with President Nixon. You were a favorite foil of his, if that's the right term.
Thank you, Mr. President. Dan Rather with CBS News. President, are you running for something? No, sir, Mr. President, are you?
And they didn't like you very much. They said they liked CBS News. They just didn't like this one gung-ho correspondent, which happened to be you. But CBS had your back. They didn't even tell you about that. Why do you think that people, particularly now that it has been discovered that you were right about Vietnam, that the press was right about Watergate, still find it hard to swallow that we challenge leaders?
Well, first of all, partly because so many politicians, not all, but so many politicians, and sometimes in both parties, have been hammering away that, you know, you can't trust the press, and particularly when the press asks questions that we the politicians, don't want them to ask. But I will say, Mike, that I do find that people I come in contact with, many of whom will say straight out, Dan, I don't always agree with you, and I sometimes kind of cringe at the way you do things, that you have to have the press challenge power. That, for example, in interviewing a president, that you never met anybody who had more respect for the office of the presidency of the United States than I do. But thank God we live in a country where our presidents are not viewed as descendants of sun gods. They're citizens who've been raised to the position of the greatest honor we have. And if there's to be any check and balance on power, a great deal of that has to come from the press. And while this is not a particularly great period, and people believing in that, I do think that most Americans down somewhere within themselves recognize that if you don't have a press that's willing to ask tough questions, then you're probably not going to have our system of government for very long, because a free and independent, truly independent, fiercely independent press, when necessary, is the red beating heart of freedom and democracy, because it's a check and balance on power. I always felt that way about it. I think one of the reasons I survived in network television for 44 years and anchor for 24 years is, while not everybody agreed, enough people agreed with that, that the press needs to be on its toes and asking tough questions as part of the system of checks and balances. And I believe it to be true today.
There was an extraordinary moment in time in 1988 when you had a live interview on the CBS Evening News with then Vice President Bush. He was running for president, And the interview he thought was going to be a profile, a presidential candidate profile, and it turned out to be all about Iran-Contra. And you challenged him like a dog with a bone for 9 minutes.
Now, if you have a question,
I do have one.
Please.
I have one.
Please
fire. You have said that if you had known, this was an arms for hostages swap, that you would have opposed it. You also said that you did not know that.
May I answer that?
That wasn't a question. It was a statement.
It was a statement.
Let me ask the question if I may first.
I have two questions about that. First of all, could that ever happen today? Would 9 minutes of live airtime be devoted to a candidate interview on an evening news program? And how did you feel while you were doing it? Because you were not going to let him get away with not answering your question. How do you do that? And what was going through the reaction that followed that like for you?
Well, no one with a half-hour newscast today would even consider running an interview that long in a half-hour newscast. Secondly, they knew in advance, while after the fact they said, well, you know, they were, quote, ambushed. That's not true. We told them in advance that we were going to ask about the Iran-Contra, that is, the deal in which we sent some of our most sophisticated weapons to the Ayatollah Khomeini in exchange for him sending us some cash, which was used secretly for war in Central America. But we had told him in advance that would be part of it. What happened was that he didn't want to answer a question about Iran-Contra. His position was he hadn't been involved when, in fact, he had been. And that was the contentious part of the interview, that he was not telling the truth. It's now been revealed since then. But the interview, it lasted as long as it did and was as contentious as it was. That was his choice. But nonetheless, what I felt at the time was that if you're going to ask tough questions, you need to insist the question get answered, or it's made clear the person who's being asked the question is not going to answer it. There's a lot of mythology about that. The Bush people, they had an organized campaign as soon as the interview was over to cast it as a, quote, a big victory for him, that he had stood off this tigerish reporter or whatever. But it's been a long time ago, but the central thing was, Mike, that we were pressing power. So that's pretty much what happened and how it happened, but I don't think that kind of interview would happen on television today, not in a half-hour newscast, no way.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll bring you up to date. Let's come to the 21st century, we'll come to 2018 and what's going on politically in this country now. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dan Rather is our guest, former anchorman of the CBS Evening News for 24 years, the longest reigning anchor in that chair in any network, in network television history, and now the author of What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. He also has a new show that's starting on the Young Turks Network, which is available on YouTube, which we'll talk about if we have time. And he'll be in town tomorrow night at 7 to speak to the Learning Society at Queen's University of Charlotte at the Belk Theater. It is said that if, as president, you attack the security apparatus of the country, you will not win. Could the same be said of attempts to denigrate the press and call every story that you don't like fake news? If you repeatedly call the New York Times the failing New York Times, if you call CNN fake news, are you not making it their mission in life to look at every little thing you do and to call you on anything that looks even remotely suspicious?
Well, the short answer is yes. But the more important thing is that you are encouraging them to look into the important things that you say and do. I take your point that, you know, it opens you up. You're just asking for it. Say, look into every little thing you do. But it isn't so much the little things. It's the big things. And the press, when a president attacks the press, as the present president has done, what he can expect is the press will then rededicate itself to doing deep digging investigative reporting that calls him to account. And frankly, I've been a little surprised, maybe I shouldn't have been, by President Trump, that after he won the election, I guess I know my hope was, and I did have some at least faint belief, that he would take the view that he needs to be president of all the people of the country, not just the people who supported him for president, and that he would change. I didn't expect to have some sea change in him, but I thought he would, frankly, given the responsibilities of the office, I just thought he might make at least some minor adjustments. He didn't. Instead, he used a poker term. He doubled down and said, well, listen, by just appealing to the 35-40% of the people who really voted for me in the election, maybe a little more than that, I can keep myself in power. He's made his decision to do that. I, as a personal opinion, I don't think it's good for the country. But more in the context of this conversation, the history of presidents who have made it a big part of their presidency to attack the press is not very encouraging as to their presidencies. And we will see as time goes along what happens with President Donald Trump. But his decision to stay on the attack, always attack the press, and to place this bet down, the public's going to believe that everything the press does is fake news and everything he does is wonderful. We'll see how that bet turns out.
When President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey last May, you wrote that you had never seen a week where a president of our nation has behaved with such a cavalier disregard for the norms and institutions of our democracy. You covered Watergate. That wasn't the case even during the Saturday night massacre?
No. I would argue not. Let's remember that as a consequence of the Saturday night massacre, another special prosecutor was Leon Jaworski was named. But there's a big difference between today and the Watergate period. Watergate being what we call for shorthand that a widespread criminal conspiracy led by the president himself. This situation with President Trump is different in many, many areas. There is some similarity to the Watergate period, but only some similarity up to now, including that in the end, President Richard Nixon was clearly guilty of the things that had been alleged, that perjury among them. With President Trump, no one has proven any criminal behavior on his part. But that week when he fired Comey, let's keep in mind that Richard Nixon never fired, nor did he try to fire the head of the FBI. I would stand by it that we've never had a week like that week. We've had some tumultuous weeks in the past, including the week of the Saturday night massacre during the Watergate, but we've never been through anything quite like this. And what interests me, Mike, is that there's a real effort by President Trump and those around him and those who support him to convince Americans that this is normal, that, well, this is just the way it is, and President Trump's a little different, but all of this is pretty normal. No, this is not normal. Many of the things that President Trump is doing, they're unique for a president. Now, I take the point that if a majority of Americans want what they see in President Trump, if that's what they want as president, that's who and what we are as a country, then so be it. But I'm not convinced that most people want what we're now seeing in Washington. I don't want, no misunderstanding here. That this is not personal with me and President Trump. It isn't a personal thing at all. It's just if you look at the long arc of history, that we've never had a first-term president in his first year and a half in office that has done many of the things that President Trump has done. Now, for those who say right and it was long overdue, I take their point, but I would gently say, we have to be very careful that when a president attacks the institutions, such as he's attacked the courts, federal judges, he's attacked the press, he's attacked Congress for most of the time, for a first-term president in his first year and a half, this has never happened before.
And he has not attacked Russia and their interference in our election. On last Tuesday, the leaders of every single security organization in the government said that the Russian threat is real and ongoing. They said Russia continues to meddle behind the scenes in trying to shape opinion and will be meddling in the 2018 midterms. And yet, there have been no directives from the president for our security agencies to formulate a policy of prevention and retaliation. How do you explain that? How do you explain the majority, I think, of Americans not being concerned about this?
Well, I'm not sure the majority of Americans are not concerned about it. I will acknowledge that the polls don't indicate that they are. But look, this is what we talked about before, Mike, about being very near to being in a post-truth political era. That there was a cyber war and a psychological war in 2016 that the Russians conducted against the United States, and we lost that war. It's not something somebody made up. The Russians meddled in our election campaign to a very large extent. Now, the question of who helped them, if anybody, in the United States, and how much, if any, it actually affected the election results is what the investigation by Robert Mueller is about. Given that, it's very interesting that the president has attacked not only Mueller, but tried at every turn to dismantle the investigation and has yet to say anything really bad about Putin and Russia. This is very curious, and it raises the question, what does he have to hide? If he doesn't have something to hide, why not take the view of, listen, I'll cooperate with the investigation in full, and let's see what the Russians have done. But I do come back to the point, Mike, and I think that you said, well, most Americans don't seem to care about it. For those who don't care about it, I would suggest just quietly and respectfully look into it. Because the Russians mounted a very sophisticated attack using the internet and the latest techniques. It was a sustained attack, and in many ways it was successful. It was a internet cyber war which we lost, and if we aren't careful, the Russians will be up to their neck in trying to destabilize us for the 2018 off-year elections, and they'll be back in 2020.
So this gets us.
The American says, well, I don't care about that or don't believe it. Again, I would respectfully say quietly, just please take a look into it because this is important.
This gets us to your book, What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. One thing that used to unite us was our adversarial relationship with Russia. If you're a patriot, you don't want Russia interfering with our elections and trying to interfere with who we elect as president or dog catcher, for that matter. Where are the things that unite us? It seems that we are so divided today, we can't even agree on that. So what does unite us in this country today?
Well, I'm very glad you asked, Mike, and it's one reason that I wrote the book. I wrote the book partly because I'd been writing on Facebook some of these same points about what unites us. And this book is not an anti-Trump tirade, as you know. In fact, his name is not even mentioned. The thesis of the book is this, that, look, we have divisions in the country, and there are things that divide us. But if we aren't careful, politicians, and some in very powerful positions, are trying to convince us that we are much more divided than we are together. They do this for their own partisan, political, and ideological needs. Now, my contention is that even though this is a time of deep divisions over race and some other things, There are many more things that unite us. Now, you said specifically what? Listen, we believe, overwhelmingly as a people, we believe in a rule of law, and we believe in equal justice under the law. Not that we're always able to deliver that, but that's the aspirations. We believe in a rule of law, no person is above the law, equal justice under the law. We believe in the principle, in both the idea and the ideal, of one person, one vote. But there are many other things that unite us.
Let me stop you for a second, because
sure.
I have 4 minutes left. You say that we agree on the right to vote, one person, one vote. We agree on the need for empathy. I'm not sure that's true, because some have viewed gerrymandering at the state level to be attempts to limit voting. Others would point to the cutting of social programs and the deportation of undocumented aliens, as well as the willingness to send dreamers home if Congress can't pass legislation protecting them, as unempathetic. Do we really believe in these things anymore?
Well, I'm keeping in mind you have only 4 minutes left. And I would say, yes, but those who pass the gerrymandering, I don't think a majority of American people agree with that. I don't think a majority of American people believe in mass deportations of people who are here. Some do, but that's not. I don't think that's a consensus of the country. But you and I may disagree about whether it is or it isn't. But, you know, there's so many more things. Like, I do think that empathy, a belief in a love of education, for example, are things that unite us. I'll stand on the ground that there are many more things that unite us that divide us, although that we do have some deep divisions.
So you've been working ever since you left the anchor chair at CBS. You do these weekly regular Facebook posts. Let's call them regular. You've done your books. You just launched a weekly television show on the Young Turks Network, which is on YouTube at 5:30, I believe, on Mondays. This is a subscription channel, and it's progressive, which means liberal. As someone who spent a lifetime in journalism and trying to report the news in an unbiased way, why associate yourself with an effort that positions itself as progressive?
Well, that's a fair question.
Okay.
And the answer is that they have a platform. With the Young Turks, I have total, complete, absolute editorial and creative control. They reach a lot of people, particularly reach a lot of young people. And I joined it as an experiment to see. I'd like to reach the people they reach on a worldwide basis, particularly young people. That doesn't mean I subscribe to everything that they do on their other programs. But I will, Mike, I want to say strongly, you know, that I'm not left wing, I'm not right wing, I'm not chicken wing. I'm an American who cares about his country, and if I can find a platform where I can reach more minds, and particularly young people, I'm going to seize it. And so that's the reason I joined the Young Turks, to do my own program. It's a platform for reaching a lot more people. It's not an ideological or partisan political statement.
So I have about 30 seconds left. You have become a millennial darling. People who never saw you on television like you. They like you on Facebook. They watch you on Young Turks. They watch you with Rachel Maddow, etc. How do you explain this appeal?
I can't explain it. I will say I'm very grateful for it, Mike, because at age 86 and counting, to have any young people pay any attention to anything I might say, it's surprising to me. In some ways, it's amazing to me. I don't have an explanation for it, but I am deeply grateful for it.
Dan Rather, legendary CBS News anchorman, and going on to other things, including his book, What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you very much, Mike.